Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. So welcome to a rare pre-recorded show where we're looking at some of the biggest stories during the year. After the 6 o'clock news, CIA whistleblower from the 1970s and 1980s, Philip Agee, in a talk he calls The Warfare State, explaining how so much of US foreign policy has been looking for enemies and how the fighting of wars has become the real powerhouse behind the US economy. That's all in the second hour after six. But I'm welcoming old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers now. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Now, we're looking at some of the big stories, we say, but also some of the less reported stories, the underreported stories. Would you like to kick us off with one of your biggies of the year?
Well, I'd like to mention a very underreported story, which is the appearance on the President Obama's website of a small, intimating that there were people involved who were inside the US power structure who might be plotting against him. And it's not really been picked up at all by the mainstream media, but is of great interest when you consider the removal of General Petraeus and various other senior military leaders for various misdemeanors over the last few weeks.
Well, that's interesting. You've plugged a particular article here on a site called Press TV, which is the Iranian national English language news channel. AIPAC decapitators inside US government, intelligence says an intelligence analyst. Has a picture of Barack Obama, and the headline is 70 hours ago at this writing, while on Air Force One, President Barack Obama issued a press release that has been utterly ignored by the Western press. It goes on to say the president has openly announced a move against violent plotters inside the US government and espionage agents. He does not use the term AIPAC or the Israel lobby, but it is highly unlikely he could be referring to anything else.
Yes, I mean, I think what's interesting about this statement on Obama's website and the interpretation being made by Gordon Duff there, who's a Veterans Today editor in the US, and he's obviously found an outlet on Press TV and not in the Western media, is this is also basically coordinated with the removal of General Petraeus as head of the CIA, ostensibly for having sex with somebody he shouldn't, and a variety of other people have also been removed from senior military positions in the US for various misdemeanors. And it may be, I mean, Duff is speculating that these two things are related, and that Obama may be moving against those who attempted to prevent his re-election in November, perhaps through engineering the Benghazi incident where the US ambassador was murdered and so on, or it may be something more mysterious than that. And I think it's interesting because mainstream media doesn't really delve in these waters at all.
Well, it's a pity because it actually looks like a fascinating story and certainly seems to be verified. I mean, even though it's from the Iranian channel, it seems some of these big stories are just not making it out to this part of the world. Let me quote from Obama's memo. It says, "The plot makes use of the resources of major private defence contractors and their intelligence and special operations personnel. There has been active recruiting that has been noted and is why the memo was released and why many members of the military have been subjected to investigation."
Yes, I think that's fairly revealing if it's correct. And of course, if you people probably won't remember Jonathan Pollard, but Jonathan Pollard was the Israeli nuclear spy in the 1980s who was working for the US government, stole all of their top US nuclear secrets, sold them to the Israelis, who then sold them on to the then Soviet Union, and he's still in prison serving time for that. Most people think that spying on the Americans or the US government is being carried out perhaps by the Russians or the Chinese, but the number one spying threat to the US government is in fact the Israeli government, now as then.
Now, the date of this press release, the president's text unedited, was for immediate release on November the 21st, 2012. And it's called Presidential Memorandum, if you want to look it up. National Insider Threat Policy and Minimum Standards for Executive Branch Insider Threat Programs.
this is of significance because I think of the removal of Petraeus as head of the CIA soon after Obama was re-elected, and he's not the only senior official to be removed. There are a variety of other senior military who seem to have suddenly been found out with doing various things they shouldn't have done and been told that they've got to go. Now, of course, this is all very opaque and it's not quite clear who's removing who about what. But I think it is interesting and of significance and basically not really noted in the mainstream media.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, this is Friday Drive Time with Tony Gosling and Martin Summers. We're reviewing the year. We're going to have to get cracking if we want to get through some of these stories. We've got quite a lot to look at. One of the ones I'd like to flag up, Martin, is the Ian Fraser, who's a city analyst. He's a blogger in London. He flagged up a particular trial from 1992 called the Blue Arrow Trial. County NatWest Bank had organised a flotation of this company called Blue Arrow and was then prosecuted for fraud because it looked like some of the traders had been, sort of fixing the price to make things better for them. In other words, saying that this company was going to be very highly valued, getting people to buy the shares at a certain price, and as the share price fell, they made money. Can you just explain how this kind of fraud works?
Well, if you've got insider information about anything, you are able to manipulate that, which is why insider trading is theoretically illegal, although in actual practice it seems that many trades that go on in the financial markets are clearly being carried out with insider knowledge. And this, of course, means that it's not possible for those on the outside of the loop to get a fair crack of the whip in terms of where they place their bets on the casino table.
And the significance of this particular case from 1992 being that it involved all sorts of fixing of accounts. It also involved various fraudulent documents which were issued at the time, and the message that Ian Fraser is saying that went out to everyone in the city at the time was that these guys were prosecuted for it. I think there were three traders were prosecuted for it and convicted, but only given suspended sentences, so a sort of slap on the wrist, don't do it again. But they then went to the Court of Appeal and got even those sentences overturned. And once those sentences had been overturned, the message went out clearly to the city that actually you can get away with anything you want to, and you're not going to be prosecuted for it. Certainly the courts are not going to come after you. One of the things Ian Fraser says is that that was really a green light for money laundering and auditing fraud. In other words, sort of cooking the books, rather like Enron.
Yes, and we've also seen more recently HSBC being given a $1.9 billion fine for drug trafficking, or basically laundering drug money. Now, in actual fact, they made an awful lot more money than that laundering the money. So in actual fact, that's another clear signal to people in the industry that in actual fact, no individual will be punished for this. The fines will not cover the profits you're going to make through money laundering. So carry on money laundering. And of course, it's also the only positive thing out of it is it flags up absolutely clearly that the banks are indeed involved in money laundering. And Lord Green was in fact head of HSBC when all of this was going on. And he's now in the current government's cabinet. I think people need to recognise that that kind of criminality at that level simply isn't punished and is in fact encouraged, at the same time as we're sending down rioters for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water.
Yes, it's pretty appalling. I mean, I suppose we ought to at least look at ways forward here. I mean, is it feasible that the courts might start getting tough on bankers here in Britain like they have in Iceland, actually sending them to jail?
Well, the problem is, if they did that, then they'd probably bankrupt the whole system. And they've now reached the point where if we were to take a hard line with enforcing the law with the financial services industry, it would collapse, and we wouldn't want that, because then capitalism would collapse and everybody would lose their jobs, so we can't possibly do it. I think capitalism will collapse anyway because of its inherent contradictions, but they won't move against them financially or in criminal prosecutions because the system is incredibly fragile.
But surely, Martin,
they will have to.
Capitalism is not going to collapse. Not until the point where at least, I mean, the city bankers, the elite, the rich are making more and more money. They're getting more and more of our wealth. They're sucking it in. And all the time they're doing that, they're not going to collapse, surely.
Well, they are, because by sucking the wealth into that black hole, they're depriving the rest of us of it. And the only thing that makes the economy work is if the rest of us are given a fair crack of the whip, which is why the whole policy is ultimately self-defeating, irrational and destructive. The system has basically has been allowed to be backed up by criminal behaviour and then backed up by the state when that criminal behaviour is found out, and fraud, you know, sort of prosecutions which don't actually do anything, don't actually add very much apart from to lift the veil slightly. And at a certain point, of course, this all will come tumbling down because it has to. And at that point, we will then talk about what really needs to be done to reform the economy. But until we've gone through this process, I doubt very much whether anything serious is going to be done.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Martin, drones. You wanted to talk about drones. You think that's a big sort of change, or something's been going on with drones this year? What's that?
Well, the most important thing from a Bristol point of view is that a conference about drones was held in Bristol in March, and basically the protesters, of which I was one, were able to close it down by making a racket and a noise, and they were basically forced out of the city. In Pakistan and Yemen and across the Muslim world, these drones are used completely illegally for attacks on supposed militants, which are never identified, and all evidence tends to suggest that most people killed by these drones are innocent civilians. Even if they were killing militants, there's no legal basis for that. The democratically elected government of Pakistan has made it absolutely clear that they don't want these drones flying into their territory and killing their people. Britain and America takes no notice. And at some point, of course, somebody in Pakistan may decide, well, if you carry on blowing our people up, maybe we should come and blow your people up so you get the message that we don't like this.
It's frightening, isn't it? Because, when I think about drones, you've got somebody sitting in a hangar maybe over in the US or in Lincolnshire controlling something which is killing people abroad. Is this actually illegal? Is this legal?
It is illegal. I think it's clearly illegal under international law. Acts of war can only take place in a notified war zone. There isn't any notified war zone. There's no war going on. Not officially anyway, and you've got to actually, if you're not at war, you've got to actually basically prove that people are guilty or innocent, not just zap them from afar.
War is just about fighting. I mean, ultimately, if you're at war with somebody,
yes, if you are at war with a state or whatever, but we're not at war with the government of Pakistan. And in any case, the government of Pakistan, the elected government, not the military government, this is an elected government, said we don't want your drones coming over the border and zapping people in our territory. And we've gone, yes, very well, but we're not going to take.
Can't
any
they just shoot
that.
Them down?
They're quite difficult to shoot down, and if you did shoot them down, you'd then end up in a conflict with the West would be fighting with the Pakistani army, which has happened this year. There have been various firefights between Pakistani army units and Western-backed army units. And of course, the danger with all of this is that you are actually provoking a further escalation in the whole business.
I mean, is it fair to say that although a lot of the talk on the news is about Iran and Syria, quite obviously Syria has been very important, that actually one of the big actual conflict zones is Pakistan, not even necessarily Afghanistan so
Indeed.
Much, but Pakistan.
And also,
why the focus on Pakistan then?
Well, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, of course, so that makes it rather threatening or potentially threatening to others. I think it's not just Pakistan. There's a whole arc of conflict running across Africa, through Somalia, across into the Middle East, into Syria, Yemen, and then on into Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And this is the strategic heart of the world, where fighting and conflict are being encouraged by outside forces as part of geopolitical games about who's going to control oil supplies, pipeline routes and so on. And the ultimate struggle is really between the NATO countries or the NATO alliance and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization alliance, which is basically the Russians and the Chinese and their allies. And ultimately there's a potential here for a full-on world war, no doubt about it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, one of our big events of the year was the G4S story. We talked to Ben Fellows, former reporter for and journalist on a programme called The Cook Report. We also had a little exclusive with Roger Cook himself, who lives in the West Country. Martin, what have been the ramifications of our little interview about how dreadful G4S were? Because there was no... It was very interesting for me in that even though we were reporting that G4S were breaking down, there was no national reporting on it until the army stepped in, the 3,500 troops. 2 weeks after the interview we did, when there was an announcement just before the Olympics that 3,500 3,500 troops were going to be drafted in to really take over the prime roles in security instead of G4S. So why do you think there was so little reporting at the start? I mean, we were getting calls from, for example, from the BBC newsroom, from the Daily Mirror, from other national media, but they weren't actually reporting it, even though we'd done the interview here with Ben Fellows on the radio about just how appalling the security standards were at G4S.
Well, I think there's an element of we don't want to rock the boat, we don't want to be seen to be undermining the Olympic Games, whereas of course we were more prepared to challenge that. And I think also we were also making suggestions that G4S might not just be incompetent but might actually be a vector for an attack. Like ICTS, the Israeli-based security company that controlled all three airports on 9/11 and controlled Schiphol Airport, where the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber were ushered onto planes without being properly checked. In other words, that G4S may not just be incompetent, they may also be a vector for some kind of terrorist attack at the Olympics. And I think that's the kind of thing that mainstream media find very difficult to deal with. But once the army are moving in, then of course they find it possible to report what they could have reported previously, that G4S were incompetent at the very least to run the show. And of course we didn't just broadcast, we were in fact tipping the army off, as you know, before they moved in.
Yeah, so the other thing is Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, was due to come to the Olympic Games. He was due to have a special suite inside the Olympic Park as well. And that was the reason ostensibly given for that, was that because on the Sabbath he wasn't able to drive, that he is a bit infirm and he wouldn't then, if you had a flat inside the Olympic Park, have to walk too far on the Saturday, on the Sabbath. But when the army took over, they said, well, there's no way we're having anybody staying overnight in the Olympic Parks. The places are going to be cleared and you're just going to have to do that like everybody else. Again, a sort of a diplomatic difficulty with the Israelis. But do you think that there was a possibility that might have compromised security, having Shimon Peres and his staff allowed to stay in the Olympic Park while everyone else was removed?
Well, I mean, that's rather the opposite of the case of what happened on 7/7 some years ago, when Benjamin Netanyahu didn't turn up to a meeting he was supposed
this,
to turn
this is
up
the
to,
London bombings
yes in Liverpool Street. I think that would have been more suspicious in a way. I think it was very odd that the head of MI5 came on the media and said that the only threat to the G4S were doing a very good job and the only threat to the Olympics was from the Iranians, because he was wrong on both counts in my view. G4S were not doing a good job, as we well knew, and the Iranians had no motive whatsoever for attacking the Olympic Games, whereas an Israeli-backed false flag attack on the Olympic Games blamed on the Iranians was a definite possibility, and it wouldn't necessarily have just been the Israelis, of course, who would have been behind it.
Well, the ramifications of this are quite big, because as you know, the company G4S is doing all sorts of things, bidding for contracts, apparently hasn't been paid for the games, but is bidding for contracts to actually do the police's job. I mean, this is a rather worrying, that a company that was seen to be so utterly incompetent in the run-up to the games, I mean, putting people that couldn't even speak English in as team leaders over former soldiers and people who really were security experts, that this raises questions about whether actually what's going on with some of this privatisation is just appalling, is that it's being handed over to people who not only are not good at the job but may have ulterior motives to become, you know, sort of private police.
Well, yes, and I think also the main point is that this private security world is not secure. Not secure at all. It's actually a potential threat. Private security is much more difficult to control than publicly managed security. And when we're dealing with, you know, high-profile events like the Olympic Games, you really can't afford to take the chance.
The YouTube film, which went very viral before it was replaced by another couple of versions of it, which is a film, a YouTube film of our interview that we did, whatever it was, about 3 weeks before the start of the 4 weeks before the start of the London Olympics. The title of it is Exclusive: Undercover reporter infiltrates security firm to expose the London Olympics, and that is on youtube.com. You can find that one there. Ultimately though, Martin, do you think that this is going to be we are going to see privatisation of the police and our prisons and that kind of thing, maybe not with G4S but some other company, maybe they'll change their name?
Well, that's a possibility, although I think their mess up at the Olympic Games hasn't helped their cause. Don't forget that G4S is one of the largest companies in the world. They have contracts everywhere, including in Israel. They run lots of prisons in Israel, including prisons which hold people without trial. Are they fit people to be running our security in this country? I think the answer is no.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Another big show of ours was the one to do with Arnhem, which I suppose is, well, I called it a bridge not far, which was looking at the bit, what is actually a very big battle towards the end of the Second World War in September 1944. The idea being really to of Montgomery's, the British general at the time, to punch into the German lines and really cut off much of the German supply lines around the top of the Siegfried Line through Holland and then into Germany. But it had to... This is the operation which has been made into a film called A Bridge Too Far. The reason that I called this A Bridge Not Far is because actually there was only about 10 kilometres or about 7 miles for the British tanks to go, at which point they paused. There was a very strange behaviour of the British ground forces, as the British 1st Airborne were literally hanging on by their fingernails, as Moffat Burrows, the American captain, said, that they were just hanging on an arm by their fingernails. Why on earth do you think those British tanks stopped? Because it seems inexplicable. This is recounted in the film a bit. I think it's Ryan O'Neill has a shout at one of the British officers saying, "Get down the road now, you know, because your boys are dying." But there they say, "Actually, no, we're going to make tea."
Well, I mean, there are lots of speculative theories floating around all of this. And as part of our research for this particular piece, I was reading the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, that's right. And he was making the point that Bormann, who was actually the real fixer of the Nazi leadership, realised after the D-Day landings that Germany was going to lose the war. He had a meeting with top industrialists and others in the German establishment without telling Hitler, and they arranged to take all of the money and basically many of the personnel out of Germany before the defeat and relocate them to other places in the world, particularly in Latin America. And for this to be successful, of course, they had to have time to do it all, which was necessary, therefore, for the British and the others not to win the Battle of Arnhem, and therefore to give, you know, for the war to run on for another few months to give them time to do all of these things. And the suspicion or the theory may be that Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was in on the planning for Operation Market Garden, which was the basis of the Battle of Arnhem, was in fact potentially a double agent working for the Germans.
It was a bit suspicious, wasn't it?
Working to undermine the battle plan so that the German industrialists and others could get the money out of Germany. And then, of course, Prince Bernhard then pops up as the founder of the Bilderberg Group, which links the Germans and the Anglo-Saxons. This Bilderberg Group first meets in the Bilderberg Hotel in Arnhem.
Yeah, it's quite weird that. Also, the other person involved in all this was another Bilderberg chairman, Lord Carrington. He was, Defence Secretary under Mrs. Thatcher?
Yeah, resigned over the Falklands.
And then he took over the Bilderbergers, chairing them. Now, this is a very peculiar organisation. As you said, started in a suburb of Arnhem, a place called Oosterbeek, in the Bilderberg Hotel. And that at the time was actually the very scene of some of the fiercest fighting, because the British airborne troops were surrounded by these SS soldiers. They thought they were going to meet very little resistance. And in fact, one of the intelligence officers who later went on to become the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, I think is it Robert Urquhart, one of the Urquharts anyway, he actually was removed because, as an intelligence officer, he said, "We should not do this operation because there are these two SS Panzer divisions in Arnhem, and if we drop these our airborne division in Arnhem, we're going to have a terrible time. In fact, they'll probably be dead by the time we get to them." The fact of the matter was, though, that they managed to hang on for long enough for the tanks to get over the bridge, the next bridge on, the second bridge at Nijmegen, at which point the tanks all ground to a halt. And the person who was in one of those tanks there, the second or third one over the bridge at Nijmegen, was Lord Peter Carrington, no less. He's commander. I mean, this is the guy who then went on to chair the Bilderbergs. So a lot of these things seem to be sort of tying up together particularly with Prince Bernhard and Lord Carrington, ostensibly on the same side, on the British side, but both, it seems, actually working in some way, potentially, to scupper that operation. I know we spoke to Tony Hibbert as part of our reports during the year, who was the major, who was the last commanding officer on the bridge at Arnhem. He's still alive and runs a nice little gardens down in Cornwall, and he says that actually that the whole thing was it could have easily worked. It's just that there was this inexplicable pause with all the tanks, and you can see that in the film A Bridge Too Far. If you've not seen it, it's well worth it, and you can maybe understand a little bit more about the history of it as a result. So ultimately, Martin, a little bit of historical revisionism, but do you think there's a point to this kind of thing? I mean, we do mostly news, don't we, but this is looking back, what, 60-70 years?
Yes, but I think the end game of World War II is a tremendously important thing to research as we're going into the start-up for World War III, because of course there's continuity in all of these things.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And another thing that we were talking about this year, on and off, has been our missing nukes story. Really two strands to it. One, maybe you'd like to start, Martin, with the missing nuclear weapons, because we've got this idea, haven't we, that all the nuclear weapons are in safe hands. There's one or two maybe that the North Koreans might have, but actually that's not the real story.
No, I mean, we have inside knowledge from those who know. And again, this is only from one source, so listeners should take this with a pinch of salt. We're only talking one source here. But the information that we are getting is that two lots of nuclear weapons have gone missing. The first are South Africa's nuclear weapons, which were developed in the 1980s and then sold to Western governments for dismantling. They have gone missing as a result of attempts to sell them on into the black market by named individuals who are very senior in the British Conservative Party. The other lot of weapons were lost during the first Gulf War, we are informed, from a B-52 bomber which developed engine trouble over Baghdad and then flew back towards Diego Garcia, dropping these weapons or warheads into the sea off Somalia, then retrieved by mercenaries who were arms trafficking into Somalia, and then again potentially sold on the black market. The link in both cases being the Rhodesian SAS, the mercenaries concerned in the first case being John Bredenkamp, and in the second case being a chap called Billy Reutenbach, both of whom served in the special forces of the Rhodesian state in the 1970s and early 1980s.
Well, I mean, let's not mince words, because David Cameron was one of the people implicated in this, at least in the story published by Peter Eyre on his blog, which, if you want to look that up, it's the UK and the US lost three nuclear weapons each. And what was Cameron actually doing at the time? Because he wasn't really a known face at that point. This is in the early 1990s, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, a trip was made to South Africa whilst there was still apartheid regime in power. And the group concerned was Sir Kenneth Warren, who's a rather senior Tory who used to have the DTI Trade and Industry Committee.
This is a little sort of fundraising group, the idea being to sell these nukes and make a bit of money.
And David Cameron and David Kelly also, Dr. David Kelly, who ultimately died as a result of the whatever he died of. The point being that the South Africans wanted to get rid of their weapons. They didn't want the ANC government to have them. They wanted to sell them on to the Western powers, to the British and the Americans. The Americans bought them directly and dismantled them. The British set up an intermediary company called Astra Holdings, which is actually a part of Astra Fireworks, if people remember that, headed up by a former MI6 officer called Stephen Koch. And they privately bought the nuclear weapons from the South Africans in order to sell them on to the British government at a profit. And a profit was made, including a profit for the Conservative Party's funds of £17.8 million, which was used for the 1992 election. But other named individuals, also made a profit. The fly in the ointment being that the chap they were dealing with, John Bredenkamp, in fact did not hand over the nuclear weapons and sold them on. And one of each of these nuclear weapons, one of the South African ones and one of the American ones that were lost, turned up in North Korea, because when North Korea exploded with nuclear weapons, you can test, you can tell where they came from. They have a particular signature, like a fingerprint. One came from the South African stock and one came from the US stock. So,
well, obviously that explosion in North Korea is well documented. Two explosions in North Korea are well documented. Is there any evidence here within the UK for this story?
Well, what we are getting is information from people who know. Now, this may be disinformation.
I mean, is it anything in the Conservative Party records or in Hansard?
Well, there is in Hansard a point where Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, asks the then government where they obtained the £17.8 million, and no satisfactory answer is received. As you say, Peter Eyre's blog covers this, Gordon Duff's in Veterans Today in the US has covered this, and we've covered this. I think that there is a degree of evidence hanging around. I mean, Hansard certainly does include Doug Hoyle asking these questions. He had been tipped off by others that the money was, you know, to be questioned. And I think there's definitely questions to answer here.
Mysterious money appearing in political party funds, I think, always needs to be looked into carefully. Anyway, thanks, Martin. We're going to have some music now and back with some more of the big stories and underreported stories like that one you just heard after the music.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, to bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
From 1955, that's Tennessee Ernie Ford and 16 Tons. We are listening to a pre-recorded version of Friday Drive Time. Very rare occurrence, but anyway, Martin Summers and I are going through some of the big stories of the year. Obviously, we cannot do this, Martin, without mentioning the mayoral elections. I mean, what's your impression of success or otherwise of this little exploit?
Well, I mean, the turnout in the end was about 30%. Which is pretty much the turnout you would expect to have in a local election. So in many ways, you could argue that the amount of interest in local politics is pretty much the same as it would have been with or without a mayor.
The other thing, of course, is that the revelations really about George Ferguson really not being quite as independent as he made out in the run-up to it. He ran a very, very professional public relations campaign. We still don't know quite how much he spent on that campaign, but certainly much more so, and a lot of support from the Bristol Evening Post giving him positive stories in the run-up to the election. He was actually a member of the Liberal Party, Liberal Democrat Party, up until just a very short time before he was elected. So most of the time he was kind of campaigning, he was actually a member of the Liberal Democrat Party, which makes me a little bit annoyed that he was standing as an independent. The other sort of thing that compromised his independence as well was the fact that he is a merchant venturer. Now he's resigned from the merchant venturers, having won the battle to become mayor. The only thing is, of course, many of the big civic events that the merchants hold, he will be invited anyway as mayor.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, I mean, he ran a good campaign and he was elected by a majority with a transferable vote. So, you know, one has to recognise that he has got a mandate to be the mayor. But I would argue, I mean, I never particularly wanted a mayor. I mean, don't forget we had a referendum earlier in the year about whether we were going to have a mayor. And there was a turnout of something like 25% with a small majority in favour of having a mayor. And when it came to actually electing a mayor, something like 60 to 70% of the electorate didn't participate. Now, that happens anyway in local politics. I mean, in actual fact, people are much more interested in national politics than they are in local politics. Perhaps they shouldn't be, but that's the reality. So the question is, how is this going to play out now? I mean, he's forming a cabinet, including he wanted to have all political parties involved, but the Labour Party didn't want to be involved, although they did have a bit of a dispute about that. And of course, the rather ironic thing is that the £32 million worth of cuts so far that he's going to have to carry out this year, whoever won, they were going to have to carry through the cuts that central government wants them to carry out. So why are we bothering? We're basically just electing our own taskmaster or jailer. And this is called localism by the central government. But it's a bit of a fraud, the whole thing, really.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Another biggest story of the year was the Jimmy Savile scandal with the BBC. Sexual abuse of children taking place on BBC premises, seems with a nod and a wink from BBC staff. One of my feelings about this, Martin, is that one of the reasons that the BBC pulled the story from Newsnight, Liz McKean's excellent interview with some of Savile's victims, was because there were people who were at the BBC who were implicated, who had allowed him to do this, and in fact maybe even made it convenient for him to do so. I understand he was allowed to park his little caravan in the BBC car park where children were abused inside there. So, I mean, it's a little bit worrying, isn't it, when you've got a corporation as big as the BBC that's censoring its own criticism.
It is, but it's also very odd that this should come out just now, just when the Murdoch empire is about to potentially be dismembered by the Leveson inquiry, and suddenly the BBC's dirty linen starts appearing in public. Why is it coming out now?
Well, it's annoying, isn't it, particularly because many of the people involved are now dead. I mean, it's almost as if it's completely soured this guy's memory, really, that he was almost sticking two fingers up at us when he was famous. And I wonder if there are other people around now who we may look back on in the future and think, well, they were rather like that too. I mean, it's completely undermined, I think, anyway, some of the trust that we have in some of the big TV personalities. Also, much of this was sort of inflamed in a way by the Labour MP Tom Watson when he made a very enigmatic statement at Prime Minister's Questions Time. So let's go back a few months now to listen to that.
Tom Watson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The evidence file used to convict paedophile Peter Wrighton, if it still exists, contains clear intelligence of a widespread paedophile ring. One of its members boasts of his links to a senior aide of a former Prime Minister, who says he could smuggle indecent images of children from abroad. The leads were not followed up, but if the files still exist, I want to ensure that the Metropolitan Police secure the evidence, re-examine it, and investigate clear intelligence suggesting a powerful paedophile network linked to Parliament and Number 10.
Well, the Honourable Gentleman raises a very difficult and complex case, and I'm not entirely sure which former Prime Minister he's referring to, but what I would like to do is look very carefully in Hansard as to the allegations that he's made, the case that he's raised, and look very carefully and see what the government can do to help give him the assurances that he seeks.
Well, it's almost as if with the Lord McAlpine scandal, who's now been paid, I think, is it £250,000 by ITV and the BBC, Martin, for not even actually naming him, but the fact that they did reports which might have referred to him, that this has all now sort of been scotched, that there is no link between paedophilia and high-ranking politicians. But actually, just this weekend in the Independent, there's another special report: police revisit the grim mystery of Elm Guest House. Boys in care were allegedly being groomed for sex at parties in a southwest London house attended by well-known and powerful figures. This is a story by James Hanning and Paul Callahan. On Sunday 16th of December, there's no more ordinary looking row of suburban Edwardian houses in the country than Rocks Lane, southwest London, but nowhere has given rise to such an outlandish series of allegations. The one formerly known as Elm Guest House claims are being reinvestigated by the Met decades after they were first made. Attempts have been made by care workers to lay bare the secrets of Rocks Lane, but to no avail. Whatever the outcome of their investigations in the past, the police team seem convinced the number of serious wrongs need to be righted. Taking allegations of the grooming of young boys in care for sex, elaborate gay parties involving senior public figures, including members of the Conservative Party, charges of a police cover-up, and even the suggestion of murder. So this is an operation that is continuing right now still, Martin. And in fact, the police have said that it's so sensitive that none of the information that they're recording is going onto the computers.
Well, yes, and it all reminds me very much of the King Cora Boys Home scandal in the 1980s and 1990s in Northern Ireland, where the security services were using the King Cora Boys Home to as a honey trap, basically, for loyalist paramilitary leaders so that they could be blackmailed. It was all covered in Hansard in Ken Livingstone's maiden speech when he became an MP. But whenever I hear the word paedophile, I start to think of blackmail. I start to think of the potential for steering public policy. I do understand that paedophilia is something that needs to be severe, you know, looked into in its own right. But there's usually an ulterior motive for the revelations about it.
So that is certainly something, I think, which we keep our eyes on. See if you can check that Independent article out online in the meantime. But I think that's one which will be raising its ugly head again next year.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, one of the other revelations this year, which is totally unreported, really, I suppose not underreported, just unreported, is our chats we've been having with the author Richard Cotterill. Richard was the Conservative MP for the southwest of England, MEP, member of the European Parliament, up till a few years ago. He's a journalist, he's worked in Fleet Street, and also for several years edited the British Aircraft Corporation's magazine back in the 1970s, BAC's internal in-house magazine. So he's quite a technology expert, now living in Italy near Venice somewhere. And we'd done a couple of interviews with him. But one of the most interesting revelations for me, Martin, was from him this whole idea of Dr. Beeching and the close down of the railways having been some kind of attempt to, first of all, de-unionise the railways, because there have been a lot of rail strikes that had brought the country to a halt, sort of closed down power stations because they couldn't get the coal. And it was an attempt to break the union monopoly, really, or the union power of the railways, and to also open up the markets for the sale of oil in Britain, and that Beeching was the man to do that.
Well, yes. I mean, Richard has obviously done a lot of research on this particular topic and other topics related to Gladio, GLADIO, which is about false flag terrorism by Western Intelligence Services, which, again, is a separate topic but not unrelated.
Yeah, he's quite an interesting guy, Richard, isn't he? The other thing he was telling me about Beeching is that very few people know this, was that he was on the project team that designed the first British atomic bombs after the Second World War, and actually brought those up to in the 1950s to be part of Britain's weaponry at the time. And Beeching was one of the key people as a physicist to down at Fort Halstead, which is a kind of secret base underneath the North Downs in Kent. All this work was done, and after he'd done that, they saw, well, this guy can keep his mouth shut about things, so let's make sure he's the guy to close our railways down. Another thing about that was that a lot of the figures were falsified about the money that was supposedly not being made by the railways. That is to say, things like they were saying that when a locomotive breaks down, you have to buy a new one. Well, of course you don't. You just shunt it off into the sidings and repair it 9 times out of 10. And they were also exaggerating the number of things like level crossings on the lines, and this is one of the reasons that they kept the whole thing so secret. The public weren't allowed to see the figures. They were just told these railway is being closed.
Yes, and of course that basically helped the car lobby. And if you look at Gladio, the attack on Bologna railway station was an attack upon public transport in Italy, probably carried out by the Western intelligence services. So that was part of a strategy of tension in Italy to try and make sure that certain political parties, particularly the Communist Party, didn't win any elections in Italy and so on. But of course, attacks on public transport are attacks on the public realm, so there is a connection there between the false flag terrorism strand of Richard's work and this stuff about railways.
Richard has actually written some stuff which is available online about Beeching, and it's called Doctor Who, because I think this is one of the things about the close down of the railways here in Britain, is that everyone knew who was doing it, but no one knew anything about this guy, where he was from. So now we know. He was working for Royal Ordnance during the Second World War. He was one of the people at ICI who was preparing chemicals, explosives for the war effort. So he was obviously a key person in World War II. But then he went on to do this. And so if you want to read up Richard's research into Dr. Beeching, why we our railways network was almost destroyed in 1963, then you can look up online Richard Cotterell, Cotterell, and look for his little piece called Doctor Who, all about Beeching. And of course that will figure big style into 2013, because it's the 50th anniversary of Dr. Beeching.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Jack Lopresti came in for the first time. He's the MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke onto our programme Friday Drive Time. And that was back in, I think, March or April this year. Martin, he's a Freemason. He was talking about Freemasonry. You know, some people say, oh, Tony Gosling, he's obsessed with Freemasonry. Is there actually any real, I mean, from you independently, do you think that Freemasonry matters?
Well, it does matter, but we mustn't jump to conclusions about it either. I mean, people can be Freemasons, and most Freemasons, I imagine, are perfectly legitimate people doing perfectly legitimate things. But we do know that Propaganda Duo, the Freemasonry Lodge, was at the heart of Gladio in Italy. All the top intelligence people, industrialists and secret service people were in that lodge, which was behind things like the bombing of Bologna railway station.
Well, that particular Propaganda Duo, was it P2 Lodge, yeah, in Italy, it was basically a secret government. I mean, they had all the chief police chiefs from right over Italy. They had secret service chiefs from across Italy. They had quite a lot of the senior politicians or mayors from the big cities, and they were meeting up regularly and making big decisions completely out of the public eye. The media, the press, the public didn't know anything about it. I mean, I wonder whether there's some sort of similar arrangement here in Britain. I mean, I look at the way the country operates and I think, well, actually, they seem to be working to another agenda. They don't really seem to be trying to do what the ordinary people want at all.
Yeah, well, if you think back to the existence of P2 and Gladio in Italy in the 70s and the 80s and subsequently, they, of course, are integrated into the Anglo-American structure. So, in actual fact, the strings are pulled from London and Washington, not from Milan and Rome.
Well, let's have a listen to Jack Lopresti on Friday Drive Time back in April. And the reason that I replay this is because he makes me a promise which was never kept. He says that he would send me the little blue book, the Bristol Freemasons Provincial Yearbook, and I can certainly appeal out now to anybody that can get their hands on a recent one of those from the last few years. Please do let me have it. It might not be best not to just post it to BCFM here, but to get in touch on email, or which is tony@cultureshop, cultureshop.org.uk, or just give me a call on my mobile, 07786 952037. That's 07786 952037, if you can get your hands on one of these Masonic Provincial Yearbooks. Because Martin, as I explained to Jack, as you'll hear in a minute, you know, it's when you've got a list of who these people are, and then you can actually start identifying, are they loyal to the oaths that they've sworn as Freemasons? And of course, if they're high level Freemasons, they've sworn many oaths to the craft rather than to the public. Or are they loyal to the people they're supposed to be serving? There's a kind of they're being tugged in two directions. On one hand, we're expecting them to serve the public, and on the other hand, they're swearing all these oaths saying that they're going to serve their fellow Masons first.
Yes, and I think, as Adam Smith pointed out in The Wealth of Nations, businessmen very rarely get together, even on social occasions, without some conspiracy against the public being cooked up.
I was happy, obviously, to declare my membership of Freemasonry. I've been a Freemason since about 2003. Not very active, probably since I became a councillor, because of, you know, evening meetings and life generally getting very busy on the political front. But I was more than happy to declare my membership. It isn't the secret society in its sense that people know of its existence. Freemasonry, I understand, again, going back, what attracted me into it was obviously, again, my fascination with history, with the fact that, you know, I thought that I may find comradeship, the good works it does for charitable works, and interesting, actually. So I didn't see, I was proud to actually say, you know, I was a Freemason, but it isn't a secret society. And in fact, my understanding is before the war, it was much more open in a sense that there were parades, lodge doors were open more than they were. But because of the fear of fascism, what happened in other countries, you know, Mussolini and Hitler trashing Freemason halls and sending Freemasons to the concentration camp, it went quiet and a bit more behind closed doors. But I think Freemasons generally for many years have realised now if they are going to survive, society is changing and they need to be more open, transparent, and they are. I mean, I'd be more than happy to arrange for you to go and visit Freemasons Hall in Bristol or one of the Freemasons Halls in South Gloucestershire, and you'll see, you know, it's a positive organisation which does a lot of good work for local charities.
I think one thing I might ask you is for the book, the little book for the Bristol Masonic book, which has got actually the names of who it is, because that's why people, I think, mostly question Freemasonry, because they don't know who the Masons are.
There are lots of organisations which don't publicise their membership, and that we could have a debate about, you know, how much that should be transparent. But if you want, I'll send you a copy.
Lovely. Okay. Before we totally get off the subject, yeah. The other thing is that when you are a Freemason, you do swear oaths, and there are a lot of people out there, including myself, who would question whether you can actually serve the public when you've also sworn an oath to serve your brother Masons.
However, you're interviewed before you go down the road of being proposed and seconded and joining that particular club. And it's made quite clear that, you know, you've got to want to join for positive reasons to help, you know, your fellow citizen and get involved in the public works. And you'd be very naive if you thought there was going to be any particular advantage or interest in joining a Masonic lodge. And, you know, a part of the ceremony and the ritual, which is based on, you know, medieval stonemasonry and the great traditions, you know, it's made quite clear all the way through that, you know, this isn't about, you know, your service as a private citizen, your duty to your family, for your job, your country. You know, it's about the traditions of, you know, going back through many years through Freemasonry. It's interesting. It's like a play. You know, there's nothing remotely sinister about it. And with the internet, you can find out probably more about Freemasonry than the average Freemason would ever learn in his lifetime.
Okay. Now on to Phil Neff.
So I'll send you the book and I'll arrange a visit.
Thank you, Jack.
Well, ultimately, no book and no visit. Martin, I suppose what we're saying here is that, you know, you can take people on trust, but then if they don't even then deliver their promises, even though they're an MP, my worry here is that he's been told, Jack Lopresti has been told by someone who's senior to him in the Freemasons, no, Gosling can't have the book.
Well, that may be so, but I will allow the listeners to draw their own conclusions, as you will.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Martin, one of the things you bring up from time to time is this organisation LEAP, L-E-A-P, and the ongoing economy. It's an economic analyst company. What does LEAP stand for, or doesn't it matter?
I'm not quite sure what LEAP stands for. It's about Local Europe Anticipation Bulletin. It's a French acronym, I think it is.
Yeah.
They're a French think tank. And they produce a quarterly or bulletin about the state of the world economy and geopolitics. And, of course, if you've got money, you can buy some of their more detailed analysis, which I think is bought by companies and governments and so on. But I've always found them very interesting and informative whenever I've looked at their material, including the most recent material, which came out on December the 19th this year.
Tell us about it, then. What are they saying?
Well, they're based in Paris, and they tend to be fairly pro-EU in the kind of things they say. So the latest bulletin seems to be suggesting that it may be that the euro is going to stabilise in 2013. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that seems to be what they're suggesting. And that the crisis will basically be concentrated elsewhere in the world, particularly Britain and the US and elsewhere.
They talk quite a lot about global fragmentation. What do they mean by that?
Well, I mean, you don't need to have a kind of degree or PhD in geopolitics to understand that we are at a crucial turning point. The US is struggling to retain its role as global leader.
Well, they say the end of the leadership of traditional powers will bring about global chaos in 2013.
Yeah, but they're seeing the European Union as potentially a source of stability going forward into the rest of the 21st century. I think they're being a bit complacent about that, frankly. I think there's many obstacles to the EU performing that role, but they people sometimes say I'm too negative. I think they're a bit positive. They see the EU as performing that kind of stabilising role, certainly for the countries concerned,
but, I mean,
perhaps for others as well.
Is it good for the people or is it just good for the markets? I mean, it seems to me that what's happening is formation slowly of a United States of Europe, and whether Britain is going to be in it or out of it is a moot point.
Well, they don't want Britain in it. Let's be absolutely clear. They see Euroland as being much better off without the UK because the UK is simply not committed to the goals that Euroland has. They were then suggesting that both Britain and the US will basically suffer from being outside that bloc, but they don't want either Britain or the US in that bloc. They're basically analysts of geopolitics. It's not just about the economy, it's about who's going to be top dog and what the implications of who's top dog are. And of course that includes people like the Russians and the Chinese and so on.
Well, that's it for our little review. After the news, the CIA whistleblower from the 1970s and 1980s, Philip Agee, in a talk he calls The Warfare State, explaining how much of US foreign policy has been just looking for enemies. It reminds me of, I think it was a book, wasn't there, called In Search of Enemies by a former CIA whistleblower, John Stockwell. How the fighting of wars has become the real powerhouse behind the US economy. And that's after the Murdoch News at 6.
Fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young.